93.5, 1590 WAKR. Kind enough to join us this morning is Dr. Carl Kaufenthaler with the University of Akron, Department of Political Science. And Carl now joins us on the show. And I reached out to him because we saw about exercises with nuclear weapons with Russia. And immediately my eyebrows go up. We've talked about it this week. Is this just sticking our chest out a little bit? With Vladimir Putin re-signing up to certainly lead that country again, or is this serious stuff? And Carl, welcome to the show again. How do you look at this?
I look at it the way you just described. I think you look at it. This is for show. This is not real. We've seen the Russians posture like this several times in the last 2 years, where they're trying to stop the West from aiding Ukraine. They've said, well, we'll use tactical nuclear weapons if NATO does this or NATO does that. And it's a bluff. Every time they get called on it, they don't use the weapons. For them to use nuclear weapons in this conflict would escalate it to a level where they would pay an extraordinarily heavy price. So this is for show. This really shouldn't be taken as they're going to use these weapons. Part of it's probably for a domestic audience, and part of it is also just to try to scare NATO into not helping Ukraine. And the main thing that really triggered this was Macron, the French leader, saying that there was a possibility that France would actually send troops on the ground into Ukraine. And so that's a big fear that Russia has, because that could potentially be a game changer. If NATO gets involved on the ground rather than just sending weapon systems and ammunition and that kind of thing, that would make it much more difficult for Russia to prevail in this conflict.
With us this morning is Dr. Carl Kaufenthaler. He's the director of the Center for Intelligence and Security Studies at the University of Akron in the Political Science Department. Carl, let me ask you this. This war has gone on over 2 years now in the Ukraine, and Russia has lost a lot of lives. Obviously, they thought this was going to be a swift movement through the Ukraine. How desperate is this country to get this done? That's why I was concerned about this, because this has obviously gone longer than Vladimir Putin ever imagined it would. Give us the state of what you're hearing and reading coming out of Russia about their desperation to get this done.
Well, they definitely are very keen on getting this war finished soon. But Russia has time on their side, and they know that this is very clear, that they think they can outlast Ukraine. More importantly, the West. They think that the political will in the West to support Ukraine will diminish over time. And we started to see this, particularly in the United States, where there are more and more voices that are saying that Ukraine can't win, or this isn't our fight, that kind of thing. And this is making it very demoralizing for the Ukrainians, because they think, okay, if the West pulls the plug on help to us, we are in a very, very desperate situation, because the Russian economy is so much larger than the Ukrainian economy, which means that the Russians can just continue to produce weapon systems, ammunition, all the things that they need to wage this war. The other huge advantage that Russia has is just numbers. They've got a much larger population to draw from that they can send to the battlefield, and it's very clear the Russians really don't care about their casualties. They are sending human waves. To this day, this is kind of the tactic they started with. They're still doing it. They're finding the conscripts. There are a lot of poor people in Russia who have joined, or people that get drafted and have to go to the front. Conditions are bad for Russian soldiers, but the leadership of Russia really doesn't care. They're just trying to grind Ukraine down. This is what we call a war of attrition, where Russia just thinks that over time, numbers will be on their side.
And, Carl, when you look at this situation, much different. You go back, for example, the Vietnam War in the United States with the freedoms that we had. There was protests and all that, and we've seen them in this country as well in the last month or so with the war in the Gaza Strip. If you speak out in Russia, all of a sudden you disappear, right?
Yeah, the ability to protest in Russia is just about completely vanished. because the laws that have been created since the start of the war, even prior to that, you protested at your own peril. Now it's really very dangerous to protest in Russia. You get arrested, or you can just get disappeared. Particularly if you're someone who's prominent, very bad things can happen to you. You may fall out of a window, which seems to be a real problem in Russia. The voices of dissent have been silenced. That doesn't mean that there aren't Russians who disapprove of this war. There are lots of Russians who disapprove of the war. A lot of them leave the country if they can. Some of them just keep quiet. And one of the things that we know from polling data is that Putin is much more popular than the war. So what this means is that while he still is supported by the majority of Russians, and we know this from some pretty reliable polls, the war is really waning in popularity over time. So this is one of the things that Putin needs to keep in mind. This may become May, like Afghanistan was for the Russians, where over time the Russian population just said, look, this is killing off our young men. We're not winning. We need to get out. We're not there yet with the Russians. And you have to say the Russian propaganda machine has been so effective in Russia in selling this war to the population as a war of self-defense, believe it or not. We even see that in the United States. There's some people who believe that. The Russian propaganda has been pretty effective here as well. But, right now the situation looks pretty poor for Ukraine, given their resource lacking in manpower, ammunition, that kind of stuff. So the Russians are hoping that they can break the Ukrainians now before significant aid comes from the United States and from the European allies.
With us is Dr. Carl Kaltenthaler with the University of Akron, director of the Center for Intelligence and Security Studies in the Political Science Department. Carl, let me ask you this. You talked about the United States and even question marks there with their aid to the Ukraine. With you certainly paying attention to this from the political science side of things, how about NATO and the strength when you look at the EU and, certainly the taps on energy has become a concern with a lot of that energy that used to come from Russia. How are they holding on, and what's the strength of NATO right now?
Well, NATO is certainly stronger now than it was in 2022. There was nothing like the invasion of Russia to give NATO a massive boost. And what it's done, it's added two new strong members of NATO, Finland and Sweden. It's also convinced several European countries to increase their defense spending and really get serious about their own defense. Part of the political process in the United States is also convinced some Europeans, I wouldn't say all of them, but some Europeans, that you got to be wary of the United States. We can't necessarily depend on the United States to come to our aid, if Russia decides to continue its attack beyond Ukraine. So we're seeing much more seriousness in NATO about defense, about countering Russia. There are very few people, I think, who are in leadership right now in Europe who think that Russia is anything other than an aggressive imperialist country. There are people in the opposition in some of these European countries who are actually actively cooperating with the Russians. And that's due to either Russia paying them off or these people have some kind of ideological affinity to Russia. If any of those kind of parties, and those tend to be the right-wing populist parties, if they come to power in some European countries, it could mean a real significant shift in policy.
Hey, Carl, before I let you go this morning, if you don't mind me changing lanes a bit, but staying on the topic, Gaza Strip, and I know they were meeting for a possible ceasefire, and nothing really materialized out of that yesterday, and Israel is still pushing ahead. Talk about that tenuous situation and globally how everyone is looking at that shot, that area there with the Gaza Strip.
Well, this is about to get a lot worse. Gaza has been just an absolute nightmare of a war because it's so small and crowded and urbanized that warfare in that kind of environment would be difficult, even if the Israelis were being very, very careful. And it doesn't seem the Israelis are being very, very careful in their warfare. And this is one of the things that's really concerned the United States, because the what we call the optics of this, the look of this war is awful for Israel, but it's awful for the United States because it looks like we're aiding and abetting what many people consider a violation of laws of war, because there's so many civilians targeted. You know, I'm not an international lawyer. I don't know all the facts on the ground in terms of how the Israelis are targeting. I do know something about how they're targeting. And it's let's put it this way. There's not the kind of carefulness that the United States would employ, for example, when the United States was fighting against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. So when Israel goes seriously into Rafah, which is where there's over a million Palestinians congregated to flee the rest of Gaza, which is destroyed basically and occupied by Israel. When Israel goes into this area, it will be a very, very ugly situation for those Palestinian civilians. And the United States government right now is very serious about trying to stop that incursion into Gaza because of the humanitarian consequences of it. But it's very unlikely that they'll be able to convince the Israeli government to stop, because Rafah right now is where the Palestinian Hamas leadership and the other groups like Palestinian Islamic Jihad, that's where they're concentrated as well. They're embedded into the population. Israel's not going to give up on their fight to destroy them. So I'm not very optimistic that this will turn out well, or there'll be a ceasefire before this gets really ugly. I think domestic Israeli politics being what they are, and the pressure on Netanyahu to destroy Hamas is so great that he will order a full-scale incursion into Rafah. And you know, we'll see what the consequences will be for the Palestinians who are there. But one of the things I would point out, I guess I'd make this my last point, is that this will have consequences for the United States. This will have consequences for our global image. This will have consequences for our relationship with some countries. And this will benefit groups like Hamas, unfortunately, but it'll also benefit our adversaries like Russia and China, who are using this situation to propagandize a very strong anti-American sentiment around the world. So this is just not a good situation for lots of different parties. But from the American perspective, this is definitely not something we think will end on a positive note.
All right, Carl, excellent information and insight, my friend. Thanks for getting up with us this morning and sharing the thoughts and certainly the research with us. Thanks again.
Always happy to be here.